Protests from Ferguson, Missouri to New York City have focused attention on recent encounters between black men and police that turned fatal, forcing the nation into another conversation about race. And not only race, but the conduct of police and the use of deadly force in carrying out their duties. There has been a lot of wishful talk in the Obama years about the nation having moved past racial prejudice and discrimination. Many scoff at the assertion that the election and re-election of a black man as its president means the U.S. is now post-racial. But if the country is not post-racial, it is certainly post-Ferguson, with more scrutiny than ever on police, the criminal justice and correctional systems, and the war on drugs. Our culture commentator Sherry Parks opens the conversation, and you're invited to join us after the news from NPR. And welcome back to Midday, our second hour. Dan Rodericks here, thanking you again for joining us. Last night, while thousands gathered in New York City to protest the decision by a Staten Island grand jury not to indict a white New York police officer whose chokehold on an unarmed black man led to that man's death, Jon Stewart opened The Daily Show on Comedy Central by saying that he honestly didn't know what to say about that decision. He then went on to say the following. What is so utterly depressing is that none of the ambiguities that exist in the Ferguson case exist in the Staten Island case. And yet the outcome is exactly the same. No crime, no trial, all harm, no foul. The coroner called it a homicide. The guy isn't acting threatening, and we know that not through witness testimony from unreliable bystanders, but because we are watching it. Someone videotaped it. We are definitely not living in a post-racial society, Jon Stewart said, and I can imagine there are a lot of people wondering how much of a society we're living in at all. Protests from Ferguson to New York City have focused attention on recent encounters between black men and police that turned fatal, forcing the nation into another conversation about race, and not only race, but the conduct of police and the use of deadly force in carrying out their duties. There has been a lot of wishful talk in the Obama years about the nation having moved past racial prejudice and discrimination, and many scoff at that assertion that the election and re-election of a black man as its president means the U.S. is now post-racial. But if the country is not post-racial, it is certainly post-Ferguson now, with more scrutiny than ever on police and the criminal justice and correctional systems. And we'll get to talk about that in this hour of Midday, and open the phone lines and welcome you into our conversation on this day after that ruling in Staten Island and also a week after the ruling in Ferguson. Joining me this hour is Midday's culture critic, Sherry Parks, Associate Dean in Arts and Humanities at the University of Maryland in College Park and author of Fierce Angels. Nice to have you back with us, Sherry.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
You know, I feel what Jon Stewart feels there, like you don't know what to say after an event like that. Express anger and disbelief that a grand jury could look at that videotape and not see that something was terribly wrong there, that a crime might have been committed. That's on one level. And another level is just all of this seems so, you know, complex, hard to talk about, difficult to talk about, as race almost always is. But we move on and we'll do it here on the air today. So your thoughts?
Well, I think... This is also a moment of hope. I think this is a tipping point. Ferguson is a tipping point. Everybody, not just the United States, but the world is watching and saying this is wrong. Eric Garner even more so pushes us maybe past the tipping point. And I think it may lead to some serious inquiry about the grand jury process, which is not transparent. And it smells of those old railroading cases in the South where black people had no rights and you ended up in prison for what we would now call zero tolerance. Selling loose cigarettes is a zero tolerance type of crime. And people are shocked that you can end up dead. What's really interesting is that there is this convergence of the two social realities. Black people are not shocked by any of this. When you see shock, it's because that there's no higher authority that can fix it, which means it was a moment of hope that part of hope has gone away. And now everybody else knows what black people have known all along, that black men are under siege. And so maybe with allies from around the world, not just in the United States, something may change.
You know, I also note the trend toward more discussion about mass incarceration.
Yes.
More discussion about the war on drugs. Beyond discussion, actually, Eric Holder and others saying, you know, we've gone too far with the war on drugs. We need to pull back and change our priorities when it comes to law enforcement. There are too many people in our prisons, too many people in prisons who need mental health treatment, who need drug treatment. All of that is part of this, I believe. And then the in Baltimore, anyway, the look at police brutality that the newspaper opened up a month ago, something that's been on a lot of people's radar for a long time, but now seems to be coming to the front page.
Well, and I think that's really important. What has become a newsworthy story? You and I were talking yesterday about the news story about the man in Potomac, Michigan, Pontiac, Michigan, who was stopped by police because he was walking around
with
his hands in his pocket.
Right.
It was cold. And the police said, well, you're making people nervous because your hands are in pocket. That would not have been a newsworthy story a year ago. It's a newsworthy story now because the media picking, you know, the media will pick up on a trend and then carry it. And that's what's happening. So now what would have been neighborhood gossip among black people now has become a newsworthy national, international trend. And, I mean, you just mentioned what was happening in Baltimore. What the Baltimore Sun reported was that since 2011, the city has paid $5.7 million in court judgments and settlements in 102 civil suits alleging police misconduct. I mean, that's in a city that needs the money, that's huge.
Right.
And we didn't know it.
There was no awareness of it. It might have been reported in bits and pieces, but it was never put together like that.
But now it's a big story.
Yeah. Today's column I wrote about a police involved shooting from 2008 in which an officer was pursuing someone that he had been searching. He had been conducting a search on, and this man, I'm not even going to call him a suspect. I guess he was a suspect in the eyes of the police officer. He was unarmed, it turned out. He ran away from the officer. This happened in Northeast Baltimore in a shopping center. And the officer shot three times. Two bullets hit the man in the back and killed him. An unarmed black man, officer was black in that case. There was some outrage about it at the time. It was momentary. It didn't last. The officer actually was indicted, which makes that case very different from what happened in Ferguson.
Yes.
But a jury acquitted him of manslaughter. So I wrote about that. We had some press reporting on it at the time. There was, I think, one demonstration, more like a candlelight vigil, offered when the man was shot in that case. But today, if that happened today, I think there would be, in the post-Ferguson America we're talking about, there would be loud and sustained outrage over that.
There were protests in Howard County last week.
Yeah, after Ferguson.
Yeah, everywhere.
Listen, I'd like to have you join our conversations today for a reaction to either Ferguson or the case in Staten Island. 410-662-8780 is our phone number here. Sherry Parks joining us again, Associate Dean in Arts and Humanities at the University of Maryland, who is our Midday Culture Critic. She's author of Fierce Angels, The Strong Black Woman in American Life and Culture. Here are some more thoughts that you can chew on and maybe respond to. What do we want? Question, what do we want? Americans want to live free and live safely, right? We want police to patrol our streets, investigate crimes, arrest, and help prosecute those who harm people or steal our property, right? We know what we don't want. We don't want to be harassed. We don't want our police to violate the civil liberties of individuals or groups. We want the police to do no harm while protecting us from harm. And that's a lot, and that's all balanced on that thin blue line. But Ferguson and the Eric Garner cases and several others before this, present us with really profound questions about what is happening to the society, even as it evolves into a more racially and ethnically diverse society. The ideal of a post-racial America, you know, people believe in this, Sherry. We've talked about it before. Some people believe, you know, we've elected a black man president once and reelected him. There's wider acceptance of interracial marriage. That's another sign. That looks like wishful thinking when you consider the way race and the two most prominent cases of fatal encounters between police and unarmed black men have come to the fore. Here we are. So we may not be post-racial. We're definitely post-Ferguson.
I want to double back to something you just said.
Go ahead.
That we're seeing this new level of danger, for particularly for black men and boys, just as we are becoming more diverse as a country. That if we take this as a higher order argument, that this may be the acts of desperation for a type of white supremacy, a widespread white privilege, that often African Americans stand in for nervousness about other racial groups. We've seen it with Asians, we've seen it with Latinos, where African Americans are the go-to pressure point. And so all of this activity around toward and against black men may be a sign of anxiety about what we know will happen. The U.S. Census Department has told us, and what year it is changes depending on what the last census says, but in most of our lifetimes, white people will become the minority. That doesn't mean that they lose power. We are in danger of becoming South Africa during apartheid, where there is a minority of people who are hanging on to power by some draconian means.
This is a comment from the, I'll read a quote here, and then we'll take a break. This is a quote from the piece in the New York Times on Sunday by Eric Michael Dyson, on an essay, a long essay in the perspective section. He says, more than 45 years ago, the Kerner Commission concluded that we still lived in two societies, one white, one black, separate and still unequal. President Lyndon Johnson convened that commission while the flames that engulfed my native Detroit in the riot of 1967 still burned. If our president, President Obama, and our nation now don't show the will and courage to speak the truth and remake the destinies of millions of beleaguered citizens, then we are doomed to watch the same sparks reignite whenever and wherever injustice meets desperation. More on that when we get back, okay? I want another quote from that excellent essay. And Sherry Parks is with us. Munir Bahar will be joining us. He's the man who organized the first 300-men march here in Baltimore in the summer of 2013 after a spike in homicides and violence in Baltimore City. He's been doing a lot of work in the streets of Baltimore and wants to talk about this. And please join us if you have something to say. 410-662-8780 is the number for Midday. Our culture commentator, Sherry Parks, in the studio with me. We're speaking about post-Ferguson America, I guess you would call it. Sherry, something else you wanted to add about the way we live today?
Well, you were talking about the Kerner Commission.
Yeah, and from 50 years ago, right? Almost.
And we still are very segregated, particularly in places like Baltimore. And as a nation, we're actually more segregated than we were in 1968 in terms of the daily lives of people.
In terms of how we live, you mean where we live, where we work?
Where we live, where we worship, with whom we socialize. We're more segregated.
I'm welcoming Munir Bahar to the studio with Sherry Parks. Munir has been on our show before. Munir, I got to know him the summer before last. Nice to have you with us, Munir.
Yes, thank you.
When
Nate,
you organized the 300-men march, which was very successful up on North Avenue, brought people out into the street to demonstrate, to show lots of concern about the violence in Baltimore City. And since then, you've been almost literally going corner to corner, talking to young men about getting out of the life and taking a different path away from violence.
Yes, and I think what's happening in this country now is something for a lot of young black men to look at, because I do believe, despite sort of, with our history and how we've evolved over the past century, we are making some progress. And I agree with you. I think there is maybe a certain sector in society, folks who want to hold on to an old America. I believe they're using these events to try to further incite hatred amongst races. If, like, if we step back and really look at what's going on, there's a lot of language now in the media inciting black folks to hate white folks or police officers. It's like it's filled with hate.
Who's doing that? Who do you hear doing that?
Well, there's a lot of underground talk in terms of conversations that are going on within different organizations on a local and national level. I do believe there are some media sources that sort of tend to prey on just the racial issues, because we've had also some white folks who have been killed by police. But you don't hear about these things. So it's, there's so much emphasis on this racial divide. I think, you know, it may take us in a direction that isn't productive if out of that you have young black folks like in Ferguson who feel, okay, we want to get up now and destroy, you know, towns.
But you're saying the focus should be on what's going on with police and their involvement with citizens on the street? Is that what you're saying?
I'm just saying the focus shouldn't be on hate and division.
I'm not with you there.
Yeah, it shouldn't be on hate and division.
Like Sherry said, this is a point of hope where there is so much awareness of it now. It's so heightened, and you see mixed races out demonstrating. Do you believe that she's on to something there?
Yes, I believe that's the course. This is a time, despite who is suffering, this is a time where all folks can come together to work towards ending suffering, racial discrimination across the board, not just for one group of person, but for everybody. I mean, 43 children were kidnapped and murdered down in Mexico. You know, that's a worthy cause for rallying around also. So there are a lot of worthy causes. And me, as a young black man, I'm saying that I am emotionally intelligent enough to advocate for myself, but also have the strength and the conviction to also advocate for others. So I know that dividing myself from others is not the answer. Mm-hmm. Going into a hole saying I'm just going to work with black folks, I don't think that's going to move us forward.
And a question for you about the work you've been doing on the streets, and then we'll take some calls. We'll go to the phone lines in just a moment. How has that worked out with the police in Baltimore City? They stand back and let you do your thing? Because Munir and his guys, they actually go up on corners and talk to young men who are out there and you think are at risk or already involved in something. How are the police in terms of what you've been doing with 300 men?
Well, the police and the city hall respects what we do. And, you know, we're not out infringing in any investigations. We're not trying to do police work. You know, we're doing the work. They actually respect it because we are preventing more body bags. We're preventing more homicide cases, you know, which makes, I don't want to say their job easier, but, I mean, I like to believe that the police don't want to, you know, come and clean up somebody's intestines and brains off the street also.
So they lay back and they know what you're doing and they let you do it?
Yes.
Yeah. 410-662-8780. We'd like to get your comments about all this. Sherry Parks and Munir Bahar with me in the studio here. Let's go to Parkville and take a call from Don and welcome him to Midday. Hi, Don.
Hi. I really appreciate the sensitivity of what you're discussing here, although I think my perspective is far more negative than your two guests. I am a white male, and my perspective comes from what I hear white people say, and I don't believe that African Americans really understand just how deep hatred there is against them in American society and among whites. So many times it's the N-word over and over again to describe it. I think there are millions of Americans when they look at Ferguson and they think, boy, they should just gun down everybody who lives there. When I hear these things coming from, you know, my society, my white folks that I come from, I don't see where the possibilities are. When several years ago, Eric Holder said we're a country of cowards that don't talk about race, I wondered, what does he think he's going to accomplish through such a conversation? You know, when the hatred is so deep.
Hey, Don, I want to ask you something. What do you say when you hear those things?
Well, I'll give you an example. This is back a number of years ago when I worked in a grocery store, and the warehouse people were all African-American. This is back in the late 70s, so it was quite a while ago. But I remember one of the truck drivers, white driver, coming in saying, you know, oh, they're human, they're human, they're human. And I remember saying to him, well, they are. And he looked at me in shock. And, you know, being around it, you know, I'm not sure what you can say.
Well, I don't think you should let it go, personally. If I hear a white person or a black person, I don't care who it is, especially a white person, go off on black people in some racist tirade, I don't sit there and say and nod and say, oh, yeah, you know, you're right, or yeah, or change the subject to the weather or something. I let him have it. That's what I personally do, but
It's tough, but to do that, and particularly if you're among friends and family. Mm. But I think more and more people, I'm hearing more and more people saying they're willing to do it. But Don, I don't think that most African Americans underestimate how much hatred there is, because it's one thing to say that in the absence of an African American, there are lots of people who are perfectly willing to say it to an African American. That doesn't mean that there is still not room for hope, despite how much anger and hatred there is.
Let's go to Aisa. Aisa?
Aisa,
welcome to the show. Aisa is calling from Frederick. Go right ahead, please.
Well, I want to applaud that it was brought up that it's not supposed to be a racial thing. It's a police thing. And that, well, I'm black, so yeah, black people do get the hatred. We got it. But it's more, I don't want it to be a racial thing, because it blinds people from the real issue that human beings as a whole are getting so desensitized that we are allowing other human beings who have certain titles like police officer to somehow have the right to justify whether or not we live. And that's just wrong in and of itself.
Yeah, I think. So one fact the folks are forgetting, all right, that the police officer may commit an action, but then there's a process by which that police officer should be judged. That process has failed, clearly, in these cases. So it's not, the police. The police are held accountable also, but then if they go through that process and then they're let free, then okay, so we can't just yell at the police. Now we got to look at the judges and the prosecutors.
That's our system, though. Sherry was talking before about how the grand jury is a secret, operation. Although in the Ferguson case, the prosecutor came out and tried to explain why they didn't indict the officer in Ferguson. But it is our system. In the case that I wrote about today in the paper, the officer was actually put on trial and acquitted, having shot a man in the back. The state's attorney's office believed, and many witnesses believed, that it was unnecessary to use deadly force in that case. Yet a jury, I assume a Baltimore City jury, I think I was told that it was majority African-American jury, acquitted that officer. I actually think people, black and white, actually have more sympathy for the situation of police officers than we think. If you were on a grand jury and you heard the testimony about how an officer felt his life was in danger, it's a different situation than just looking at the facts from the outside. I just want to throw that out there. Now, one other thing I want to add is an attorney I spoke with yesterday who represents a lot of police in cases like this. He says we conflate two things. The concern about police brutality, mass incarceration, the war on drugs, those things that I mentioned, or police-involved shootings, use of deadly force in encounters with young black men, all legitimate, important issues. But he says we conflate those things with the more serious problem of brutality by cops. That all gets conflated with these high-profile shootings, these high-profile cases that end up with fatalities, in which each circumstance has a set of unique facts, right? So we get all this mosh together and think of it all as excessive force, all of it police, the state authority crushing black men in our society. When he thinks you should separate out these shooting cases, you might not be talking about a case where there's a video, right? But there's a unique set of facts in each of those cases that may lead an officer to use deadly force, is what he's saying, broader, bigger issues.
I would disagree, because I think we have a tendency to chop things up into categories. There's a continuum. There's an overarching idea of police having been given more power, more license than they have in any period since Jim Crow.
And prosecutors, too.
Right, and prosecutors who are...
And judges with mandatory sentences.
Because people are afraid. Those people that Don was talking about who are angry, they're also afraid. And sometimes they've been made afraid who are they angry at? Are they angry at specific people? No, they're angry at this kind of mythic figure. It's a continuum. And the day-to-day misconduct is a part of the everyday fabric of life for some people in this country. And sometimes they die.
I'm with you. I didn't say I agree with his attorney. Yeah. That was the point he was making about conflating these things. And he likes to separate everything out a little bit. And I'm with you on
then
that.
We miss, yeah. Then we miss the connections.
I'm with you. Matt in Baltimore, you're on Midday next. Welcome to our show.
Hey, good afternoon, everybody.
Hi.
I think everybody's been pretty much hitting the nail on the head. And I'm from Baltimore, and I guess you could say I'm a Caucasian male. I guess, well, actually Mediterranean, but Caucasian. We're a little mixed. But I'd like to say this. Coming from my point of view, the non-indictment in New York was a clear injustice. It was a slap in the face to Americans, and mainly to African Americans. It was a slap in the face. And I think, this is going on. There are a lot of progressive whites.
Yes.
And they can't stop us. All the whites, blacks, Asians, everybody needs to stand up and put their foot down, because this has to stop. And let me tell you, I just want to speak from the heart right now. My son is Korean, African, Caucasian, and it's very hard for me to explain these things that are going on to him. And it's got to stop.
Matt, I want to ask you this. What has to stop? What are you saying has to stop?
It has to stop.
Are you saying racial profiling has to stop?
I could go on for a long time about this. Like the gentleman spoke earlier, I think there is some kind of secrecy behind trying to split everybody apart, but they can't do it. They think they can pull the wool over everybody's eyes. There is a lot about race, but it's not all about race. They are trying to divide us. Who, think about it.
Okay. Well, who is it? Who is they, though? I'm trying
the
to get
gentleman,
it.
The yeah. gentleman nailed it on the head earlier. I can't pinpoint it, but it seems like the media, they just push this out from both angles. Push it out.
Can I respond to him?
Yeah,
well, I want to say two things. I think that they may be, you know, people in power who have built their power based off of racism, have built their power off of exploiting other people. Let's say they. Is they one color? No. You know, but who they are? I don't know. What I do know, and this is my message to young black men now, and I am a young black man, is that in times of confusion, in times where you just don't know, the best thing you can do is be still and just center yourself and be in touch with yourself, so that you don't make the wrong decision or the wrong choice that can further injure or put yourself in a vulnerable situation. I do not have I'm 33 years old. I come from the streets. I changed my life, got out of the streets, went to college, became a powerful force in the community of Baltimore. I'm very well educated, but I do not know everything right now. But what I do know, it's safer for me to not let my heart be filled with anger or hatred or to go out and incite violence or anything against anybody else. So while there's some things for us to figure out, again, my message to the majority, well, all of young black men, we have to be cool so that we can get through this process and understand.
When there are powerful forces that act in a culture, it's tempting to think that people get up in the morning and decide that they're going to do something to other people. We have to recognize how deep in the bones of this country race and racism are, and that there are many people in power who are just doing what they've always done and not considering the harm that comes to them because they don't see it, because they're protected from it. And we have to understand that in order to eradicate it. And I've said for years that decent white people need to take their race back.
Need to what?
Take their race back. Mm-hmm. That when we say white now, we mean bad white people. And there are many more, I still choose to believe, good people of all races who don't want this to happen in their country.
When Matt says it has to stop, and I asked him, what does he mean? I like to get specific there, but what is it? Is it racial profiling? We don't want the police to stop policing. We need the police to police. What has to stop?
Stopping
young black men on the street for having their hands in their pockets? I would agree with you.
What does policing mean? By policing, do we mean shoot to kill, or do we mean community policing, where police are part of the community and prevent crime because of their continued and involved presence.
Do I want police stopping a guy for selling single cigarettes on the street? Do I want police stopping people who might be holding marijuana in a pocket?
Well, and that's...
I don't anymore, no. Not necessarily,
The Eric Gardner case is very interesting because the police were stopping people for selling loose cigarettes on the street because the vendors, the merchants, were complaining because guess what? They're selling loose cigarettes on the street. So one group has a little more power than the next, and they want to, in this case, literally eradicate the competition.
Right. Barbara in South Baltimore, we welcome you to the show. Hello.
Yes. I want to say this. It seems to me that the role of the police is to serve the community and protect the community, not police the community, which is what they do to the African-American community. And I want to say this to the young man who just made a statement about his own self. I can assure you that the majority of those people that are in the street are just like you, mm-hmm. except they don't feel safe. They feel that they may be shot down any minute. And by the way, you may be too. I mean,
well, Munir's not far from that. He's felt that way in the past.
Yeah, I mean, see, this is nothing new for me as a young black man. And you got to understand, my life coming up, 99% of my problems did not come from a white person. When I was in the streets, 99% of my conflicts came from another black person. So it's not the thought of I could die any day is not new.
What about encounters with the police when you were coming up?
Well, I mean, I sold drugs, so I asked for it. I mean, if you play the game and you fall, you know, it's a part of the game. You know, I had to remove myself. And since I've removed myself, I don't have those encounters
with
police.
Did you feel threatened by police when you were growing up? When you were selling drugs?
Because, well, one thing my mother instilled in me was respect. So, hey, if they got me on the curb, whatever, I was smart enough to know this person has a gun and they can kill me. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to be as respectful as possible.
I think there's a big difference between hope and naivete. And I think some of the callers are thinking that both of us are naive when you can face the social reality as terrible as it is and still see an opportunity. And I think that's what both of us are saying. It's not because we don't know.
Right.
It's not because we haven't seen or lived. It's because we have gone through that in our different ways. And I'm not suggesting my life is like your life. It's in many ways been quite different. But there's hope. There's still hope.
And we choose, despite what's going on, to be strong. We choose, despite what's going on, to fill our hearts with love and with a determination to see a better outcome for everybody. That's a decision that we make.
And that has been the genius of survival of black people historically, to be able to do that.
Sherry Parks with us for this hour of midday, along with Munir Bahar, organizer of the first 300 Men March. He continues that program in Baltimore City. You have an event coming up tonight?
Yes, we have a community meeting for black men tonight at our headquarters at 904 Washington Boulevard. And this is the talk, not really around the events going on, but around how we move forward in this country, again, with a heart of seeing an opportunity to move forward as young black men, but as it relates to how we deal with each other inside of our culture, so intercultural things, but then how we relate also to the rest of society.
That's tonight at what time?
That's tonight at 8 o'clock at the Core Health Institute at 904 Washington Boulevard.
Got it, Munir. We'll repeat it again before the end of the hour. An email I'll read as we go to a break from Erica in Catonsville. Regardless of which side you agree with, please remember that there are bad people in all walks of life. Bad cops, bad teachers, bad CEOs, even bad priests. We need to remember that the majority of the police are good, hardworking men and women who put their lives on the line every day for little pay or recognition. Don't let what happened in Ferguson encourage people to disrespect the police and our laws. 410-662-8780 is our number. The midday email address, midday@wypr.org. Alice wrote in with a story from over the Thanksgiving holiday. She said, I had a tense moment with a family member regarding the 12-year-old boy who was carrying a toy pistol. This is Tamir Rice in Cleveland. She said, I said that if it had happened in a white or affluent neighborhood, the officer wouldn't have shot so quickly. That racial profiling caused the officer to be more likely to think a weapon in the hands of a black child was real than if it were in the hands of a white child. My family member's response was that you couldn't deny that violence is more prevalent in black neighborhoods and that therefore it was not racism or stereotyping by the officer, but judgment based on existing reality. How do you guess suggest that someone respond to such a mindset?
In that case, the policeman drove up to the 12-year-old boy and shot him twice at close range. So he had an opportunity to have a conversation. And I want to be able to say this, there is more reported crime in black working class communities. And that's really important because that gets conflated. I've heard people all week conflate those two. That's very different from saying there is more crime. In rural communities, in affluent communities, there is a great deal more freedom to act out and not get arrested. And there have been very clear studies about crime statistics, arrest rates versus behavior. And so we have to be really careful about saying there's much more crime in black working class communities. There are many more arrests. And that becomes the statistic.
Wouldn't that support the person who's arguing here that the police were basing their judgment on existing reality?
No, on existing social reality, but not on the actual facts. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I get you.
Yeah.
All right.
That constructed social reality becomes very real, and they respond on that perception because we don't report either at the level of the police or in the media on crime that occurs in, quote, surprising places. Does that make sense?
I get you. Munir, you wanted to say something before about some of the comments that people are making from a distance when it comes to Ferguson and on the streets of Staten Island.
Here's my frustration. I've been building a mentoring program for young men, and this is, you know, it's been predominantly African-American men in the city for 13 years. And I'm like, why all of a sudden now does Black Lives Matter? You know, I see this, these hashtags, Black Lives, like all of a sudden Black Lives Matter. Like, what about last year, the year before? I have gotten such little support from Black people themselves.
For 300 Men March?
The predecessor to that was Brother to Brother and
mentoring,
CORE, the programs I've been running for 13 years.
Yeah.
So I don't like the fact that it takes some type of national incident for all of a sudden.
Why don't you like it?
People
it's happening.
To understand.
It's the existing reality. It's actually, we're talking about this today. This is post-Ferguson. I think it's a good thing. I'm with you. Why didn't it happen sooner? The Kerner Commission was almost 50 years ago. But we are talking about it today. Sherry even thought at the beginning of the show that we're reaching a tipping point here.
I actually agree with both of you.
Yeah.
It is human nature to respond to a death because people are trying to survive and live their daily lives. Should African Americans, we're going to both get in trouble here, should African Americans take more responsibility for fomenting social change? Yes. A good example is that there is slavery in the United States. What other population has the moral authority to say never again? Several of us have tried to start conversations around slavery ending in the United States among African Americans, among middle class African Americans, and gotten silence. So there are many examples of African Americans not taking on.
What do you mean ending slavery?
Ending slavery. They're slaves in the United States. They're by some measures 50.
You're talking about human trafficking?
Human trafficking, okay. Not just sex slaves, but labor slaves.
Mm-hmm.
And so who in the United States has the moral authority to say never again? I do. You do.
I see what you're getting at.
There are people, and many of them in Baltimore, the American Service Friends Committee has worked with us of trying to get, and you know, I did a show on this. I'm trying to get middle-class African-Americans to say, just to say it, never again. This is our issue. These are, you know, these have been our ancestors, and people were not interested. And so Munir and I are saying the same thing, that yes, there are lots of people out there, both good and bad on both sides. Are African Americans taking the stances that they need to take, doing the work that they need to take? Not enough of them.
Okay. And in the case of Ferguson and now the aftermath of the Garner decision on Staten Island, you have more white people involved in this.
And
that's, taking part in the demonstrations, calling our show.
And that's a very good thing.
Let's take another call. Jerry in Jessup, thank you for calling Midday. Go right ahead, Jerry.
Well, I just wanted to offer some information about the grand jury process. I think the average person doesn't know that the grand jury is pretty much a creature of the prosecutor, of the state or district attorney. It's not like a petty or court jury that hears both sides. You hear only one side. And there's always a nexus, a bias between the prosecution office and the police department. I mean, they work hand in hand. The police bring the cases to the prosecutor. They take them to trial. And so the prosecutors are either knowingly or unknowingly biased in the direction of the police. And we all have biases in our lives in every direction. I don't think they're often recognized. But the point I'm trying to make most clearly is this. The grand jury returns an indictment or fails to return an indictment based on solely the information they hear from the prosecutor. They don't hear both sides. It sounds like the grand jury in Ferguson may have had access to a lot more information than this grand jury. The one in New York seemed to me to be a circumstance where the prosecutor did not want to see that officer charged and pose the information in a sympathetic way, and the grand jurors are all selected from the roles, much like regular jurors are, and they believe in the honor and integrity of the prosecutor's office, and they follow suit. They go as they're directed. So I'm not surprised what happened in New York, because I think that prosecutor didn't want to see that man charged.
Jerry, let me ask you this. It would seem to me that a remedy in all cases where a police, say a Baltimore City police officer, say a Baltimore County, let's switch to Baltimore County, Baltimore County police officer is alleged to have done something, committed a crime, involuntary manslaughter, or something like that.
That has happened.
It would seem to me that if you're going to take that to a Baltimore County grand jury, that you should have an independent prosecutor. You should not have a prosecutor from Baltimore County who may have who every day has associations with Baltimore County police officers. Would that seem to push it further?
I think your point is well taken, but it's odd that you choose Baltimore County, because Baltimore County has, contrary to the mischief I'm describing, has done otherwise. They have indicted. The prosecutor out there is a Scott Schellenberger. He has sought and obtained indictments of police officers who were engaged in the deaths of other people. And the last occasion I recall, I believe a jury acquitted the person, but a jury hears both sides. And, you know, the charge is beyond a reasonable doubt. And juries do what they believe they're sworn
well,
to do.
Very good. Scott Schellenberger could do that. I mean, any prosecutor can do that. The case I mentioned in Baltimore City, Pat Jessamy brought a case against a police officer. But wouldn't you would remove the issue that you raised about a prosecutor manipulating a grand jury by bringing in an independent prosecutor, even an assistant attorney general or something?
Right? I think what you're saying is an excellent idea. I think it would certainly create that conflict of interest. It's a very real conflict of interest when the person who's alleged committed a crime is a police officer.
Thank you very much, Jerry. Thank you. Let's take another call. Lorenzo in Joppa. Lorenzo, you're on Midday.
How are you? Great show today.
Thanks.
I agree with the young man, your guest there.
Munir.
I apologize. Where do we go from here as black people, as black men, as black communities? Where do we go from here? You know, every time something happens, we march. I get it. You know, we scream and we shout and we holler and we cry that everything's unfair. I mean, you know, racism is a reality. Bias is a reality. But what do you do about it? I mean, are we going to educate our kids more? Are we going to have more of our kids join the police department? Are we going to send more kids to college to become lawyers so that they can become prosecuting attorneys or attorney generals? Are we going to vote more? I mean, it stands to reason that the issues in Ferguson, you know, probably wouldn't be so bad if a lot of the people there voted and participated in the political process. I mean, we can't just stand around expecting someone else that's not like us to treat us the way we want to be treated if we don't stand up and do something ourselves. I mean, don't get me wrong. I'm a father of two young black men, and if something happened to one of them, I just don't know what I would do, okay? But at some point, you know, I got to tell my sons, get out there and do what it is, you know, I've taught you to do. Get out there and be responsible, because, you know, then these things don't happen. When the police pull me over, hi, sir, yes, sir, yes, sir, no, sir, yes, sir, thank you, Mr. Lorenzo, and they move on because I seem like a professional individual. So, I mean, I just think we need to start determining what are we going to do to change the system ourselves.
All right. There's a lot there. Lorenzo, thank you for expressing that. Munir, do you want to add something?
Yeah,
there?
I'm going to say, not to be self-centric, but what I've been doing for 13 years is what we should be doing. We should have been doing. So let's talk about what we need to stop doing. We need to stop patronizing violence and ignorance in our music, in our television. We need to stop prioritizing sports over the education of our children instead of spending 3 hours each week watching football games. That could be 3 hours of cultural competence training for young people. We need to be financially responsible. We need to stop waiting for the government to build places for us when we can pull our money economically to build rec centers, which we have done in Southwest Baltimore. So it's not just what we need to do, but we also have to look at what we need not to do that contributes to a breakdown in our culture.
There has to be a recognition that a rally or a protest is simply a way to gather attention. And in order for them to have any efficacy, there has to be a conversation afterwards. And so you shouldn't go to a rally unless you know what your two or three talking points are going to be after the rally.
Some comments on Twitter. Kalila says, I reject the notion that black people have not been working all along to address issues in our communities. I also reject the concept that black-on-black crime is any more egregious or prevalent than white-on-white crime. Crime is committed against people by those in their communities in our segregated nation. That means they likely look like you. Black-on-black crime and police brutality are different issues. People must stop conflating, and black folk should stop repeating falsities. Our midday Twitter account is Midday WYPR. Back to the phone lines. Carl in Catonsville, go right ahead. Hi.
Good afternoon. It is really a great show. I wanted to kind of go back to what you had asked about earlier about who is the they and what should we be addressing. As I told the screener, you can have a police force without them making it a police state. And I think that they've gotten far too comfortable with what they're doing and what they have been doing, and now that a light's being shone upon it, it bothers them. And it's like, well, no, we've been violating civil rights and doing this all along. We've been stopping people in Detroit for walking with their hands in their pockets forever. So why are you calling us on it now? The racial component is there. It's always going to be there. But then when you add the authoritative component of this person literally at that point in time has your life or death in their hands, they can make that ultimate decision, and no one's going to check them on it. And they keep proving this time and time again.
Thank you very much, Carl. And I'll add to that an email from Danielle, who says, you hit on an important question when you asked one of the callers, who are they? The problem, as I see it, is that we are all they. We all have been raised in a racist society, and racism is therefore ingrained in us. We need to turn inward and identify our own racism in order to prevent it from ruling our behavior. Well said.
Yeah.
Do you want to add anything, Sherry? We got about a minute left here. We have time for one more call. If someone can be really quick on this. Ernest, can you be real quick with your comment, please?
Yeah. We didn't. The white people didn't accept the O.J. Simpson verdict. They didn't accept that. So why should we have to accept the verdict? I mean, it wasn't even a verdict. Grand jury in both of those states of these murders, and orchestrated by the prosecutor, and that steered the grand jury wrong.
Okay, Ernest, thank you.
Well, the interesting thing about the grand jury system is that it's not double jeopardy to indict them again.
It's not double jeopardy to indict them again. Do you mean
right.
to go reopen the case?
Right.
Right, because there hasn't been a trial.
Exactly.
There's just been an investigation. Thank you very much. Sherry Parks is the Midday Culture Critic. She joins us once a month on this program, sometimes more often than that. She's Associate Dean in Arts and Humanities at the University of Maryland College Park, author of Fierce Angels, The Strong Black Woman in American Life and Culture. Munir Bahar, as organizer of the 300 Men March, he continues that program. Tonight he has a program, 8 p.m. at 904 Washington Boulevard, specifically for young black men to attend and to talk about this issue and others that affect them.
Yes.
Thank you, Munir Bahar.
Thank you.
Nice to have
you
with us again. And Sherry, always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, everybody. See you again soon.
Midday's senior producer is Nikki Gamer. The producer is Maureen Harvey. The associate producer is Michael Hemowitz. Our interns are Carrie DeSantis, David Richman, and Marjorie Goodman. Midday's engineers are Matt Taka and Luke Spicknell. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcast and live streaming is available at WYPR.org. Dan Roderick's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.